Your Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we are going back to kind of my roots as a writer and Writer's Voices roots to welcome back today one of our very first guests that we ever had on the show back in 2006, Paul Merrill. Now, Paul graduated from high school in 1969 at the age of 16 and headed for Europe with two high school friends to attend a German language school. When the others returned to the U.S., he spent the year traveling around the world. And since his first job selling zucchinis at age 8, Paul has worked as a grocery store box boy, grocery store clerk, karate instructor, bus driver, postal worker, daffodil picker, meditation instructor. I'm going to skip over a few. High-rise window washer, I knew about that one. And a Christmas tree lot manager, I knew about that one too. And he has bought and rehabbed 13 houses, been a landlord, a technical writer, a business writer, a magazine editor, a cartoonist, and now a novelist. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Paul.
Thanks, Monica.
And you are now living in Mexico, I understand, whereas you used to live kind of down the street from me in Fairfield, yeah. Iowa.
Yeah, exactly. I've been in Mexico now for 5 years.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And did it take moving overseas to finally finish this book, Fast Food Detective?
That's a good question. I think it was just, you know, iteration after iteration after iteration, and I finally ended up with the last one here.
So Paul and I were in a writer's group for many, many years. I think I was trying to figure out when we started. I know it was before 1995, and it might have been even in the 80s, in the late 80s. What do you think?
I moved to Iowa in 88. I'll bet you it was around 1990.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And and Paul and a few others of us were in that group from the very beginning. Other people came and went, but we kept meeting for decades, really. And and we had hoped to have a third member of that group with us today, Crystal Guerin, who is my assistant at Writer's Voices. She does my blog posts at writersvoices.com and creates the YouTube videos out of the audio that we record by adding a couple pictures and posting it on YouTube. And but she unfortunately was not able to be here. But I believe that Fast Food Detective was in the notebooks even back then. Is that true?
Yeah, I started it in 89.
Okay, so yeah, so I would have seen very early drafts.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I remember getting one back from you that had all kinds of corrections all over it.
Sorry about that.
No, that's great. That's the way I learned. I had to learn how to write. I didn't know how to write anything.
So let's just, how would you, you know, what's your elevator pitch for what Fast Food Detective is?
It's a detective comedy romance spoof on men and women's relationships.
And I couldn't say it better myself. That's a pretty tall order.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, writing a detective book is challenging enough because you've got to get a mystery that engages people in some way. A romance has its own challenges. Detective and romance don't usually go together. Usually a detective is pretty hard-boiled. You know, whether it's a man or a woman, they're, you know, loners usually. Mm-hmm. There's often some romantic element in it, but it's not usually a primary part of the book. But then when you throw in the element of comedy, you just gave yourself a really tough assignment.
No question about it.
Yeah. So why? Why did you want to write that?
I was actually house-sitting a house for a friend in Seattle, and I was working on my first book that I never finished. I was writing this book, I'd been working on it for maybe 9 months or a year, and I woke up one morning with this idea in my head, and I just started laughing. And I thought, I've got to write this. This is great. And since I'm already working on this other book, I'm going to get this book done in 3 months, maybe 4 months, and get back to the other book. And that was 32 years ago.
That's not exactly how it happened.
Right.
So you started with this idea, this concept, and was it mainly the character, your detective?
No.
No?
No, actually, it was the concept, the greater concept, which I don't want to say because I don't want to.
You don't want to give it away. Yeah, yeah. It's hard to really talk about this book without spoilers, yeah. Giving away things. Yeah.
But the general strange, the kind of weird concept of the book, that's what popped into my head.
Now you had a background in comedy, right? You've done, if I recalled, weren't you in an improv troupe for a while? And right. And do you think that, how much did that contribute to this process?
You know, I've just always thought that our senses of humor is our biggest gift from God. Mm-hmm. You know, that we can actually find something funny and laugh about it. And so it kind of all plays together. I just think it's really important for people to laugh. And so getting into the improv theater definitely sparked me. Definitely kept me going. But I think I'd actually started this book before I got into improv.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. So you sat down to write this. You've been working on something else at the time. You sat down. What was your, did you like write a whole first draft quickly and then spend the next 30 years rewriting it? How did that work exactly?
Yeah. The answer is yes. You know that saying where they say writing is rewriting?
Yes. Yeah.
I think I wrote the first draft in about 2 weeks, something like that. I mean, it really just came out, just flowed. But it wasn't exactly the same story because there were lots of elements in there that I didn't use and then lots of elements that came up later.
Yeah. So I will, you know, I would have read a fairly complete draft of this book maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And so when you published it last year and I got the final version of it and I reread it, I was actually surprised at how much better it was.
Good. I'm glad that it was better, not worse.
Yeah. And because there was a time as I knew you over those years and you were reworking it, rewriting it. And there was a point when I thought, you know, he needs to just finish and go on to something else. It's good enough. It's okay the way it is. But you kept at it and you actually did make it better. Which could have not happened. It might have, because sometimes things can be overwritten, over edited.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things that you learned that helped you to make it better in the end?
Wow. When I first read it, I mean, I first wrote the original draft, I gave it to a friend of mine who was because I originally wrote it as a screenplay. And I gave it to a friend of mine who had been a professional reader in Hollywood. So this is the person that gets stacks of screenplays every day and just goes through them and chucks them in the garbage or, you know, finds a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave it to him. And what came back was so he used a red pen to make corrections. It was almost the entire thing just looked red.
Ooh.
I mean, he tore it apart. And so at that point, I started reading stuff on how to write a screenplay. And I read Sid Fields. He has a great book on screenplay writing and, you know, developing character and all that kind of stuff. So I read a bunch of those things, and then I talked to you guys in the writing group. I got great feedback from you guys. It was amazing. And that would change every time I'd get that. Like, I think we were meeting once a week for a while.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'd get something, and I'd go, wow, I didn't think about that. And I'd go in, and I would change that and improve it. But a real interesting one was I kept finding these people that were, you know, kind of progressively more experienced in the field. And I gave it one time to a friend who passed it on to a friend of his that was a successful, you know, New York Times bestseller author. And she said, typical of an amateur, too many adjectives and adverbs.
Mm.
And I was like, what? You know, so, you know, I loved my adjectives and adverbs, right? So I went back and I started looking at how, if I took the adjectives and adverbs out of a sentence, did it make it stronger or weaker? And basically, I stripped the entire thing of all the adjectives and adverbs, and then I went back and started putting the ones in that I felt were good, that were needed. The interesting thing is that once I got it to the point where I thought it was completely, what's the word? It was a clean, mean machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
I gave it to another person who wasn't a professional, but was, and this was actually only about a year ago, who was just a person that reads all the time, you know, like reads a couple books a month kind of thing. And you know what her comment was to me, Monica?
It was too lean.
No, she said too many adjectives and adverbs, just like what? An amateur. Yeah, that's after I thought it was completely trim.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I went back and all the adjectives and adverbs that I put back in that I thought were so important, I started taking them out again. And I took out over half of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was like a real eye-opener for me.
Yes. And it's an important thing because what it means is that instead of relying on adjectives and adverbs, you are finding the right verbs and nouns that are more specific. And more descriptive in and of themselves. So when you were taking out the adjectives and adverbs isn't enough unless you have the right verbs and nouns. So were you changing those at the same time?
Yeah. I would look at a sentence and see how it impacted me.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, you know that saying for writers, they say it's not what you say, it's what you whisper.
You know, I haven't heard that one.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's one of my favorite ones. So it's like you don't want to say something and be completely out front in somebody's face. You want to create this feeling from the sentence that makes that person kind of use their imagination and suck them into that whole feeling of what you're doing. And so I had to play with that a lot because, you know, stripping the adjectives and adverbs out of the sentence, it had a whole different feel. And so then I would have to change things and redo it. And then, of course, once the sentence was redone, then you have to go back and check the meter to see if it still flows.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And that actually, I can remember many times going through the book just for meter and rhythm. You know, because if that meter or rhythm is wrong, it pulls you out of the book. And it's like, you know, oh, this doesn't feel right. And then you're out of the story.
Right, right. Exactly. So, Paul, why don't you read a little bit from, well, actually, first, why don't you introduce us to the book, kind of the character, the setup. Set up a fast food detective for us.
Okay. So, it starts out in a fast food restaurant. The hero is named Larry, and he's the assistant manager. And his boss is kind of this crazy, wild midget guy that, you know, is talks in baby talk, who's very controlling oriented. And they get in a fight, and Larry gets fired. And he goes out and tries to get another fast food job, but he's blacklisted because everybody finds out that he got in a fight with his boss. Mm. And so he decides he's going to pursue his childhood dream of being a detective. And
he reads a lot of detective novels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's one of the ways that he gets in the fight with his boss. He's reading a detective novel at work. He actually is down and out, and, you know, he can't get a job. And that's when he accidentally finds this book called How to Be a Detective. And it's like, oh, my God, this is my calling. So he goes through the usual thing. You know, when you first start to set up your business and you've never done it before, you know how you get excited about your business cards and all the things that don't matter?
Yeah.
So he does that whole thing, and he doesn't get any calls at all. And he's going through his money. He's getting depressed. He spends all his time watching detective movies, and he's basically given up. And one night he gets a call from this man who says, I want to hire you. And he comes up with all these, well, let me check my schedule and see if I've got time, you know, kind of stuff, which is another beginning business trick.
Mm-hmm.
And the man says, you know, don't BS me. I've been watching you for 3 months. You have no money. You've never had a call. I'm sending you somebody to pick you up in 10 minutes. be out front. So he gets picked up, and surprisingly, he gets picked up by this huge limousine, and he's taken up to this private manor through gates and to this massive estate and taken up to this library where he's sitting. Actually, I think that's where the quote starts.
Okay. So do you want to read?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So here is Paul Merrill reading from Fast Food Detective.
Here we go. So he's sitting there in this chair waiting, and he says, wow, I guess I've hit the big time, he whispered. After some time, his feet began to hurt. He sat down in the red chair. He couldn't remember when he'd arrived, but there had been more than an ample time to summon whoever was supposed to meet him. He picked at some mud on his shoes. The tick of his watch began to annoy him, and he pulled his sleeve to cover it. He crossed his legs, uncrossed them, then dropped some lint from his pants and watched it hit the floor. I wish this guy would hurry up, he whispered. There was a loud crack. The door behind the desk flew open, smashing into the bookshelf next to it. Larry looked up, his eyes riveted on the barrel of the gun in front of him. There was a blinding flash and the pounding thump of gunfire. Larry dove for the floor, grabbed his .45, and pressed his back against the desk. Spent casings bounced on the floor around him like pieces of brass popcorn. Books flew from their shelves, and fragments of wood and pieces of paper exploded into the air. With his back to the desk, his gun drawn, and his heart pounding in his ears, Larry realized something peculiarly odd. Whoever was doing the shooting wasn't shooting at him. He was firing randomly around the room. Then, as abruptly as it started, the shooting stopped. Across the room, a book fell to the floor with a thud. Books, parts of books, and wood chips littered the room. Nicole, a man's voice yelled. Yvonne, Yvette, Charlotte, Suzette, on the double, let's move it. Instantly, five young women dressed in short, ruffled blue dresses and white aprons appeared at the far end of the room. Clean up this mess, the man yelled. On the double. Yes, sir, the girl sang out. Running to a cabinet, one produced a bottle of wood glue and a handful of clamps. Another grabbed a dustpan and broom, and another a handful of garbage bags. The girls threw themselves into their work, tossing pieces of books into bags, dusting away splinters, and gluing shards of wood back onto the shelves. Larry looked around the end of the desk. In the middle of a haze of blue smoke, a large man in camouflage pants and a black tank top stood next to the desk holding a machine gun. Bandoliers of bullets crisscrossed his chest, and a string of cartridges dangled from his gun. His hair was short and gray, flat on top, and his mouth clenched an unlit cigar. He threw the gun on the table, unclipped his bandoliers, and dropped them to the floor. Larry got up and dusted himself off, his hands shaking a bit more than he would have liked. Never underestimate the value of a good entrance, Mr. Gibson, the man said, seating himself. Now let's get down to business. Yes, ready, Larry said, wiping the sweat from his chin and the cartridges from his chair. The man leaned forward and pulled a cigar from his mouth. Gibson, do you know who I am? Larry looked across the table. The man's face didn't ring a bell. No, sir, I don't, he said. I'm J. Paul Gettit, the richest man in the world. Gettit? You got it, the man said, jamming his car back in his mouth. Call me J.P. He looked at Larry hard, then leaned back. You'd think I'd be the happiest man in the world, having all this money, wouldn't you, Gibson? A huge estate, servants, maids, power, admiration? Larry looked around the room, at the chandeliers, the fluted ceilings, the walls of books, the paintings and statues. Yeah, he smiled, I certainly would. Well, I'm not, J.P. snapped, flinging his guitar through the air and hitting the statue of Athena on the breast. The girls returned their things to the cabinet and retreated through the door. Closed, J.P. yelled, then looked back at Larry. Do you want to know why I'm not happy, Gibson? J.P. opened a drawer and lifted a photograph. He looked at it for a long time, then threw it on the table. Her, he said. The picture was of a striking woman in her early 50s with a kind face and a beautiful smile. My wife, he said. Then almost in a whisper, Sarah Payne Gettit. He picked up the picture, gave it one last look, and tossed it in the drawer. She left me right after joining the N-O-O-W. His eyes narrowed and his face grimaced. Do you know what N-O-O-W is, Mr. Gibson? Isn't it some kind of women's group, Larry said. The National Organization of Organized Women, J.P. said through his teeth. Now, I've been through eight wives, Gibson, eight, and they all left me, and all for stupid reasons. But Sarah, she was the best. His eyes lost their harshness. We had a perfect marriage. Everything was wonderful. She did everything I said when I said it. When I wanted something, she got it for me. When I was sick, she looked after me like a mother. She was the perfect wife, Gibson. Perfect. Then she left. His jaw tightened. I'm sorry, Larry said. Maybe she just needed to, he searched for the right word, you know, explore her feelings, get in touch with. Call me Pinko shit, Gibson, J.P. yelled. She did it. J.P. spun around and pointed to the wall behind him, at a woman's picture hanging where there should have been an animal trophy. The she he was referring to was an attractive woman in her mid-30s, blonde brown hair pulled back in a tight bun, a slightly taut smile on her lips. To either side of her hung giant moose heads with large, motionless eyes and lacquered tongues. Venus Van Damme, the president and CEO of Now. Sarah joined that stupid-ass organization, and suddenly nothing was right. Nothing about the way we lived was right. She wanted more freedom. She wanted more of this. She wanted more of that. She wouldn't do what I wanted anymore. Nothing I could do was good enough. And I wasn't in touch with my inner child. He roared, slamming his fist down on the table and sending spent casings into the air. I was a male chauvinist pig, he said, pounding his chest. Me! The next thing I knew, she was leaving. He folded his hands on the desk in front of him. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to endure, Gibson. I became bitter. I started my own organization, Macho, M-A-C-C-C-C-H-O, Men Against Contradictory, Combative, Criticizing, and Confused Housewives Organization. We're a small but dedicated group of men sworn to bring down those damned libbers. Those damned libbers who don't know their place, who go around wrecking it for the rest of us. Professional libbers who undermine the very structure of society and steal men's wives off to stuff envelopes and talk about equality. The hell with equality. If a woman can do everything a man can do, what's the use of a man anyway? He leaned back. On a clear day, I can see their headquarters from my bedroom. He shook his head. That's hard. Do you know what it was before it was their headquarters, Gibson? No, sir. It was the Balls R Us Athletic Support Company. Jockstraps, Gibson. Ironic, isn't it? They converted it. Did a lot of construction, too. Who knows why? It was one hell of a rock-solid building. It probably wasn't pretty enough for them, and they needed to get all the man vibes out. Only women workers were allowed on the job. Men would have been too crude. When I look at it, JP said, slapping his desk with his pen, all I can think of is Sarah. It's torture for me. I'm sorry, Larry said. She's the one who's responsible for this, he yelled, turning to the picture on the wall. Her, that feeling-spewing, living slime ball. If it weren't for her, my Sarah would be here right now. He looked at Larry. The muscles in his cheeks stood out like walnuts. I may be bitter, and my life may be ruined, but I want hers ruined too, he said, pointing at the picture. Anything you can get on her, he hissed. The pen in his hand snapped. I want her destroyed. I want her head right up there on the wall, right there with the rest of them. He leaned toward Larry. You want the assignment, boy? Larry coughed. Excuse me, Mr. Get It, but I don't think I could. He looked at the trophies. You know, kill someone. I don't mean kill her. That's just a metaphor, man. I mean take her down. Destroy her, look into her history, find the dirt, bring it out and make it public. Everyone has some kind of dirt, find it. Embarrass her, disgrace her, discredit her, make her life miserable, make her pay for what she did to me. JP folded his arms across his chest. My wedding anniversary is 2 months from tomorrow, Gibson, and that's how much time you've got. I'm not going through another anniversary without knowing she's hurting too. It may not be the nicest first assignment for a new private eye, but it's what I've got. He leaned across the table. So what's the verdict? Larry tapped the arm of his chair. Let me think about this until tomorrow, if you don't mind, JP. I need to see how I feel about an assignment like this. Feel? Are you a woman, Gibson? For Christ's sake, use your head. Here's the first case for a PI who's never had a job in his life other than pounding patties in some doggy diner. JP chewed his lip, leaned back, and looked hard at Larry. Okay, I'll be honest with you, Gibson. Let's put our cards on the table. I'm famous and I'm rich, which makes me a target for certain unscrupulous types. For that reason, I'm not going through the normal channels on this thing. You're a nobody. And you've got no credibility. I could deny anything you say or do as easily as I could spit. That's your strong point. My reluctance to have this out in the open and your lack of credibility provide you with a unique opportunity. He looked at Larry and ran his thumb back and forth across his chin. And I'm willing to pay you $5 million to do it. plus expenses. Murray coughed and cleared his throat. $5 million? He squeaked. That's right, Gibson. $5 million. You want the assignment or not? Well, JP, like you said, this is a unique opportunity. JP reached across the table. We got a deal? Murray smiled and grabbed JP's hand. Yeah, JP, we got a deal. Off to one side, in a space between bookshelves, the head of Athena revolved silently on stone shoulders. An eyelid lowered to expose a small lens. The lens focused on Larry, buzzed, and the eyelid closed. JP leaned back in his chair and smiled. Cigar, Gibson? The head rotated again. The eyelid dropped, and the lens pointed at JP. There was another buzzing sound, and the statue was still.
And that was Paul Merrill reading from Fast Food Detective. And Larry is about to embark on the adventure of a lifetime.
That's right. That's the setup.
That's the setup. So after all the years that you worked on this, how did you decide that it was ready for the world?
You know, Monica, I decided it was ready for the world about 50 times before that.
Okay, I believe that.
And every time I would go, you know, sometimes I would go, okay, well, I want so-and-so just to read it and check. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes I would be done with it, and it would be like somebody would say, oh, can I look at it? And I go, yeah, I guess so. And then they would come back and they would have some criticism that was right. And it was like, oh, no, now I've got to rewrite the whole thing again. So this last time, it was a combination of just like going, I've got to get rid of this. I've got to let this go. Do you know the quote by, I think it's Picasso, that says, a work of art is never finished. It is only abandoned.
Yes. Yeah.
And I really like that. And so I guess maybe the last person that I showed it to had very few corrections. And I'd been going for months. I'd been going, this has got to be the last time. And so it was like, okay, not a lot of corrections. It's done.
Yeah. Were there periods of time where you just put it in a drawer and didn't work on it, didn't think about it?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, many times, one time for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, because what would happen was I'd come to a situation. Somebody would point out, actually, it was pointed out to me, you know, this can't happen because that's against the law of physics or that's against the law of electricity. It can't happen. It would kill him. And I'd go, oh, my God, that's like a main point of the story. Like, how do I get around that? And I would just go, you know, because I wasn't getting paid for this. I was working jobs, you know, rebuilding houses or writing for the Palm Top paper. And I would go, I can't deal with this. I've got too much to do. And so I put it away and I'd think about it every so often. It's like, God, I can't figure it out. And that one time after 5 years, I went to a party at somebody's house at night in Fairfield, and it was a fire outside. Mm-hmm. And we all talked and it was fun and great. And somebody asked me about the story and I said, I'm stuck. You know, I haven't written on it for ages. I can't go anywhere. And that was the end of it. And so I got in my car and I went home. And as I was getting ready to go to bed, it was like, that's it. It changed the whole thing. And guess what, Monica? It was one additional line.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, it was one line and everything worked out. You know?
Whoa.
Yeah, crazy. 5 years of sitting on the book for one line.
Wow. And did that line stay in?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yep. So it's finished. You're going to publish it. What was your next step?
And that was a freaky one. Actually, I finished it, and for an entire year, I did nothing with it because it was like, I know nothing about marketing. How I know nothing about anything. You know, I mean, I like writing. I used to, you know, I would hear people say, you know, writing is such a chore. And it's like, I heard so many times people would say, it's like giving birth. It's like painful and this whole thing. When I would write this book, every time I loved it. Every time I got energy. Every time. So the writing, that was me. And then it was like, now I got this book. What do I do? How do I even get it published? How do I get a cover? And I sat on it for a year, and then finally I went, you know, I got to do something. So I went up on Fiverr.
Okay.
Fiverr is a clearinghouse for you know, people.
Gig workers, basically. Yeah,
exactly. And I went through Fiverr for a couple of days, and I found somebody in Croatia that I thought, well, this sounds pretty good. This sounds, you know, he'll take my book and turn it into a book and all that kind of stuff, and it only cost me like, I don't know, $200 or something. And so I sent it to him, and it was a big mess. But it got me started. You know, it got me started. And then I thought I had it pretty well done. And I saw this person on Fiverr that was a publicist. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be what I consider now to be my mentor. And she has written over 90 books and been on the bestseller list and, you know, the whole thing. Her name's Mel Cottle, and great lady, great person. And she just basically helps writers, you know, like she doesn't need the money. So I sent it to her and I said, I've got it here. The book's done. I'm ready to publish it. You know, and you say you're a publicist. Can you help me? And it turns out she was so much more than a publicist. And she said, you know, I'll take your word for it that it's finished, but send me like 4 or 5 pages, you know, while we're on Skype, right, or Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent them to her, and she said, on this first page, I can see 4 typos. And I went, you got to be kidding me. And she said, yeah. And I went, and she kept reading, and she said, yeah, on this page, there's 5 of them, and on this page, there's 2 of them. And I went, you got to be kidding. She said, you want me to give it to my team and have them edit it? And so that started the process, and Mel basically got me through it.
Okay.
The other guy, all his editing, he was from Croatia. He didn't speak English as a first language. His editing was not good, but he got me my cover. And that was
And how did he do that?
Actually, you know, here's the cover, if you remember.
Yep.
I had tried a number of different things. Different ideas, pictures of people, you know, as a detective with French fries, holding French fries and all this stuff. And I finally didn't like any of them, and I was frustrated. And one day I just sat down with a piece of paper and I said, this is what I want. I sat down with a felt pen. I said, I want it to go here and here. I don't know what kind of font, but I want it to go here and here and here. And I just, you know, wrote things. I wrote Fast Food Detective, an offbeat novel by Paul Merrill, in felt pen. And then I looked at it and I went, wow, that's better than anything I've done before. So I sent it to this guy in Croatia, and he put in the gun and the picture of the French fries and worked it up and sent it back to me as a file that I could put on Amazon.
Okay. So, hold the book up again. I'm going to take a quick screenshot.
Can you see that? There we go.
Yep. There we go. Awesome. Okay. So you had the cover from that, and right. Then you had this person who had a team of copy editors, right? Because copy editing and content editing are two completely different skills.
Right.
And so you didn't need any more content editing.
Right. Though these guys, the guys on her team, they did a lot of good stuff, but a lot of stuff they changed, and it was like, no, that's changing my book.
Ah.
just a couple words, but it's changing the book. So then I went back through it and I put back all this. They made some really good points, but I put back a lot of stuff, probably about 50% of the stuff they took out, I put back.
Interesting. Yeah. And by the way, as you were reading, I was like listening for adjectives and adverbs, and there really were not very many at all.
There's not many. I know.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. It really hit home with me, and I actually prefer it that way now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So did it change how you write just other things now? Yeah.
Actually, the way that I write, and I'm dying to write. I've got two or three novels I'm dying to write, but I don't have time. Mm. I'm working on a book on yoga.
Ah.
Yeah, which is not that creative compared to something like this.
Right.
So it's not quite as exciting, but.
So why are you doing that?
Why am I writing a book on yoga?
Yeah.
Because
if it's not exciting to you.
Because I think it's needed. Mm. It's, you know, Monica, what it is it's a book on yoga for people who don't want to do yoga. And I think there's a lot of people out there like that. It's like I went to a 200-hour yoga teacher training down in Oaxaca, Mexico. I loved it. It was where you live there in residence.
Right, right.
I totally enjoyed it. I totally loved it. I was excited about it. I came home. I did my practice that I'd learned from there for about 4 days, and I quit. You know, it was like, it's strenuous. It was strenuous. It was a lot of, you know, a lot of these postures that were hard to hold. And I would come up with these really brilliant excuses of why I couldn't do it. You know?
Like, such as?
Such as, I don't have time. I need to eat right now instead of do yoga. And then, of course, you can't do yoga right after you eat.
Right,
you
know? Right.
And then I've got to go to this appointment. And I've got Pilates. And I've got the gym, you know. So I was actually in Fairfield because, you know, I would go up to Fairfield for a couple of weeks to work on a couple of houses I have up there. And I was lying on the floor of one of the houses before I rented a house that I used to live in. I was lying on the floor going, I don't want to do my yoga. I am tired. I don't want to do it. And I just was laying there staring at the ceiling. And then I thought, you know, this pose that I'm doing, you know, which is a corpse pose, laying on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I love this pose. And that's the way I got started with this book. And so the type of yoga that I'm writing this book on is what I do every morning and every evening.
Mm.
And I've been doing it for 3 or 4 years now since I came up with it. And I love it.
So it's like a combination of different techniques or?
Yeah. It's basically a bunch of standard yoga techniques and a bunch of stuff that I came up with myself together.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun.
So will it be with photographs or illustrations or?
Actually, the book is actually just going to be a reference for a video course, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know, if you do a video course, like I've bought video courses before, and it's like you really don't, if it's like, oh, I wonder about that one particular thing. You don't want to have to go boot up your computer and go to the thing and then find out where in this video is that one question, you know, answered.
Yes, yeah.
So for that reason, I'm writing the book.
Okay.
So you can go, oh, yeah, that, and open it to a page and go, oh, yeah, I remember that's the position, fine, and close it and go on.
Okay, that makes sense. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Paul Merrill, author of Fast Food Detective. I want to ask you about some of the other things you're working on that are up on your website, but first, so you had an edited copy then, and then what was the next step in terms of your publishing journey?
You know, that was really cool because I didn't know where to go, and Mel has done 90 of her own books and helped a whole lot of authors, so she knows it's just like you know, it's like in her brain, it's wired into her brain. She knows exactly what to do. So we got the copy back. I made some changes. When we got it to the point where we wanted it, she came up with, she put it on whatever software she had, came up with the gutters, the indentations, the margins and all that. And then it was just time to upload it to Amazon. And one thing that's interesting is that my understanding anyway might not be exactly correct, but you upload to Amazon and there's a pre-sale time. And when your book actually goes live for sales, that time before that time when you can do pre-sales of the Kindle version gets counted as purchases on that first day.
Mm.
So if you have, say, 500 or 600 people do pre-sales of the Kindle version before that first day, then on that first day, maybe you sell 20 books, but it actually comes up as 620 books. And it's part of the way that they determine, what the best-selling books are.
Right. So did that work for you?
In theory, I've been focused on this yoga book, and when I get it done, I'm going to focus on marketing both of them. But I send it out, I put it on Facebook and I send it to a bunch of people on my WhatsApp, and I think I sold like 20 in pre-sales and maybe like 10 since then. So I haven't sold many books at all, but again, I haven't even tried to market it.
And it is a print on demand. You're using Amazon's print on demand and Kindle.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And you get to set the price.
Yeah.
That way.
And that was another interesting thing with my mentor Mel, because you can set your price and completely wipe out your market, And she told me a story of somebody that had, felt that her price was so her book was so good that the price should be huge. And she said, no, you need to, this should be $7.95 or something. And so once she changed that, she sold books. And so I let Mel kind of give me suggestions on the price.
Okay. Yeah. And then, hopefully you get some reviews.
Yeah, Mel, that was interesting too. Like I said, I should really encourage friends or something to put reviews on. She said, don't worry about reviews. She said, they'll happen automatically. And they're much more powerful when they do. And she said, I think it was Never Stop Running, which they're making a movie of. I think Sony or somebody is. She said, I've got like 3 reviews on it. She said, reviews are not a big deal.
Really?
That's what she says. Yeah.
That's interesting because as a buyer, I definitely consider how many reviews a book has.
Yeah, I do too, actually.
Yeah.
To her, it's not a big deal.
Huh, interesting.
And that's based on her sales, right? On
her
sales book, so, yeah.
Yeah. So do you did you ever think about going the traditional publishing way instead of doing this?
Boy, did I ever. I went to 5 writers conferences, Tucson, Arizona, and someplace in Washington State and California, University of San Diego, they're big conferences and you meet with agents
and publishers.
From
PR.
I did that. And it was really interesting. I got this feedback from a number of these agents, and these agents are usually not, the heavy hitters in New York. They're usually people that are starting out or they're junior.
Right. Right.
Folks. And they would say, fiction is hard to sell. We like nonfiction, especially self-help books. They say, fiction is hard to sell, but you know what? The hardest part of fiction to sell is comedy.
Yeah.
Comedy fiction, and it's like, but that's what I wrote. And it's like, and you know what? I was sitting at lunch one time with 3 of these agents from New York, and they said, and we were talking about life, right? And they said, you know, we're not so interested in your comedy book. That'd be really hard to sell. But why don't you write a book about your life?
Yeah.
We'll sell that one.
Well, I mean, your blog, your bio on your blog, you've got a lot to write about.
Yeah, I probably do. Yeah.
Have you thought about doing that?
I have. I'm kind of like enamored with these two fiction books that I want to write. Then after I do those, I probably will.
And in the meantime, you're also writing a joke book.
You know, I should take that off the website because, Monica, yeah, I wrote this joke book. I had, 123 or 122 of my favorite jokes out of the last 20 years. I was super like, you know, I'd edit it and I'd be laughing. It's like, the world needs this book. This is great. So I was going over the same things with Mel, you know, the cover and the back cover and
the and layout.
And she said, listen to this, Monica. She said, and so have you contacted all the authors of these jokes? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, jokes, you can copyright a joke. And I went, what? And she said, oh, yeah, let me take this joke. And she took the like the first line or the punchline of one of my jokes, typed it into her computer. We're sharing screens, right? So I can see this.
Right, right.
And it comes up and there's like 20 entries of this joke. And she said, you will have to go to 122 people and find out who did this joke and ask them if you can publish it in your book. And they're all going to want money.
Yeah. And it was,
okay, that's the end of that book. So, so Monica, I made, I think I made like 10 paper versions. And I gave it to friends. So I'll make a note to get that off my website.
I think that's a good idea. Now, you also have on here that you're creating a course on how to live high on little money.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually that's one of my pets that I've had for a long time. And I've been taking notes. I just love it. And in that course, I'm probably going to have – because I've been studying how to fly free around the world for years. You know, I took a course online for $20 that basically told me nothing. Gave me one good idea, but started me thinking. And so I've been working on this how to fly free course for years and how to live cheaply. And I've flown all over the world for free. I've flown to India and Mexico a whole bunch of times. And that's probably India, Mexico, all around the U.S., mostly a lot of trips in Mexico. I think there's about 20 trips I've taken for free.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just tricks. It's just tricks. And I haven't seen a course out there that really tells you how to do it, but it's super easy.
Oh, cool.
But you know what's interesting? It's only in the U.S. Europe has the same kind of thing, but it's the credit card game, right?
Right, right.
And Europe has the same kind of thing, but they don't give you very many points, and Mexico doesn't even have it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Canada, it's not strong. It's the U.S.
Yeah.
We are the consumer, you know, the consumer gold.
Yep. Yeah, I guess they always figure they get you, you get the card, you're going to keep using it, they're going to make money off of you.
Well, and they're also figuring you're going to miss the payments, and then they're going to nail you.
Yeah, no, yeah, no. Yeah. So you have to, yeah, you have, do have to watch out for that. But I remember years ago you talking about living in a foreign country, dirt cheap.
Yeah.
And I now mean, that's what you're doing, right?
Yeah, Mexico's not even the cheapest because Mexico, when I was in high school, Mexico seemed like more of a third world country. And now it's, you know, it's bumped up. I don't know that it's on the level of Switzerland and the United States and England, but it's definitely up there. I mean, you know, I live 3/4 of a mile from the beach, And, you know, it's like, if you want to get close to the beach, you're talking $600,000-$700,000 for a house.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Or into the millions.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on if you're waterfront.
Yeah.
So, but like I take Pilates, private Pilates lessons from a master Pilates teacher here for, you know, it's slightly under $30 for a private lesson. And that same lesson in the United States is 110.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we close, because we're about out of time, you have two more novels that are on the book. They're obviously not going to take 30 years each.
No, they're not.
So are they, are you still in the same genre, or are you switching genres?
One of them is kind of the same genre. It's a romantic comedy. Which I'm really excited about. The other one actually is a drama. Yeah, it's a drama. And it's, yeah, that's going to be really interesting. It's not not a comedy. Yeah.
So what will you do differently this time around?
I'll write it in 6 months. I won't put adjectives and adverbs. Well, actually, I will. You know, when you write, you have to go from your right brain. You can't be editing. For me, that's the main rule.
Yeah.
So I'll write it, and there'll be tons of adjectives and adverbs in it. But I know now about how to clean it up, and I also know about character strength and that kind of stuff. And character strength used to be so nebulous to me, and I couldn't figure it out. And now it's like, you know, I heard this before. It's like people would say you let your characters happen. You know, they take on their own lives. And I didn't understand that, but now it's like, yeah, it's like when you're writing, you go, he wouldn't say that. You know, that doesn't make sense. He wouldn't say that. And you change things to fit the character.
Yeah. 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 So they start to write themselves in a way.
They start to write themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, this one big point for me is when I'm writing that kind of fiction, you know, I feel like I'm plugging into, I used to call it the deep FM station, because it's almost like I feel like I'm plugging into a radio station that's feeding me. It's like, where's this coming from? You know, and I'd be using words and I didn't even know what they meant. And I would look them up in the dictionary and go, wow, that's perfect.
Well, Paul, I'm so glad we finally got a chance to talk about Fast Food Detective. And I'm looking forward to the next book. And we always close with a quote, and I'm going to do the quote from the top of the About Paul section of your website.
Okay.
If you want to write, you've got to experience life first.
Right.
Yeah.
And I agree with that one.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
And thank you, Monica.